proceed to case number six, please. Olson and Schultz, five, pardon me, Olson and Schultz versus Risk Management.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm David Phillips. I represent the plaintiff appellants, Mr. Schultz and Ms. Olson.
Can you talk louder, please, David?
Yes, Your Honor. What we're talking about in this case on both the plaintiff's claims that lost in the district court are Section 1692G of the FDCPA. There are various requirements under 1692G of what a debt collector has to do when it's trying to collect the debt. One of them is known as the validation notice, the 30-day dash validation notice, which is a clause that this court has repeatedly visited in a number of cases, including the decisions in Avila versus Rubin, Bartlett versus Heibel, and Chauncey versus JDR. Another part of Section 1692G is the debt collector has to state the amount of the debt. And this court has recently visited that provision in Miller versus McCalla and Veach versus Sheeks. Now, in the district court, the court ruled against our claims that, first, the validation notice had been overshadowed, the 30-day provision, by a statement that the amount was now due, was stated in the collection letter twice, and also ruled against our claim that because they had two different amounts stated without an explanation of what the two amounts meant, that it hadn't effectively conveyed the amount of the debt.
Counsel, what legal authority supports your position?
Well, I think that
A violation of the Fair Debt Collection.
Well, I think Avila, Bartlett, and Chauncey support it. In those three cases, this court was
What language in it?
In those
what
cases?
Language in it do you say support?
Oh, in the collection letter or in those decisions, Judge?
In the decisions.
In the decisions, the language in those decisions basically are
quoted.
Well.
That you're relying on, please.
I'll be happy to, Judge. There's an extensive discussion in Bartlett versus Heibel where
it's quoted.
It's a fairly long quote, Judge.
Well, give us that part.
I'll give you a part where at one part it says the net effect of the juxtaposition of the 1 week and 30-day crucial periods is to turn the required disclosure into legal gibberish. Okay, and that's, I believe, at about page 500 of that decision. And that's what these other decisions said, Your Honor, which is, in Avila, this court was confronted with where a collector said, pay us in 10 days. Okay, in Bartlett, the time period was pay us in 1 week. In Chauncey, it was pay us within 30 days, because to effect payment within 30 days, you'd have to mail the payment before the expiration of the 30th day. But where, if you want to dispute the debt, you could do it on the 30th day. And there's also a decision out of the Fourth Circuit from 1991, Miller versus Payco, where they use the phrase now. The teaching of these cases is where you use a time period that's less than the 30 days, and you don't explain how that time period fits with the 30-day period. In fact, Judge Posner went to great lengths, this court went to great lengths, and Bartlett versus Heibel and even wrote a collection letter and said, despite the fact that we told you to do X, Y, and Z in this time period.
That letter's been criticized.
It has been criticized, but, from the plaintiff's bar, it's been criticized that even the form of that letter would violate for other reasons, but Judge Posner actually was very careful about the 1692G and said, I'm just writing this about 1692G. You might do something else in this letter that may violate a different provision, like make a false threat under E or whatnot. But, Judge Posner's letter is the law.
Let me ask you this. If you were advising a debt collector and the debt was one of these ones where, let's say, $4,000 is owed on the total debt, but $1,000 right now to bring everything back to back
current
speed. Current.
Sure.
How would you express that, or how would you advise the debt collector to express that in the letter?
Just like you said, I'd say, you know, the total amount you owe is X. My client, you know, Mr. Creditor, will take Y right now to bring you back current. It's that simple. And it would also be that, and that would comply with 1692 GA1. Because then you know what's at stake. I owe this whole amount, that's what's in default, but they want me out of payment plan or I'll become current. And it's the same with 1692G, the validation notice. It would have been very simple to fix these letters. And although we've asked that you pay this amount now or today or, you know, a week or whatever, you have 30 days to dispute the validity of the debt, which is exactly what Judge Posner and that panel suggested in Bartlett versus Heibel, is explain how these conflicting time periods fit together. And that's where I think the district court went wrong here, which is Judge Leinenweber, all due respect to him, he likened it to a credit card statement where the creditor sends out a bill and says, you know, your total balance on your Visa, you know, thanks to your December spending, is now $5,000. But your payment for this month is $500. Okay? That would be fine. Okay? But this is not the creditor. This is a third party with whom the consumers have no prior relationship, no prior dealings, and a creditor is not covered by the validation notice. There are things that are in credit card statements that would violate the Fair Debt Act, namely if the creditor put in there, you know, your due date is the 15th of the month, which is a week off. You know, that would be a conflicting time period, but creditors aren't covered by that. There's a prior pre-existing relationship. And that's actually why Congress exempted creditors from the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which is the theory being, and I'm not sure if it's quite correct nowadays, that there's an ongoing relationship between the creditor and their client that would sort of rein in the creditor from doing some of the things that a debt collector would do. I think that, you know, with that all the creditors are getting bigger and bigger, I don't know if that's necessarily true anymore, but that's the state that we have it right now. And I think that's what we need to look at here. Is it not the consumer's duty to understand the letter? It's the debt collector's duty to effectively convey both pieces of information to the consumer. And that's what didn't happen here. They didn't effectively convey it. They gave a conflicting time period without any explanation. And they gave two different amounts. And both of these violations, I think they are violations, could have been simply fixed by just a short explanation. This is what we're trying to do, and they didn't do that. And I think that unless your honors have any further questions, I'll save the remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right.
May it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Vance. I represent the Appellee Risk Management Alternatives, Inc., or RMA. Judge, the trial court's decision should be affirmed on the strength of Johnson versus Revenue Management Court. There, in a fair debt case like the claims here, this court already held, if all the plaintiffs have to go on is the language of a debt collection letter, they must lose in the end. All the plaintiffs had here was the language of a debt collection letter. They lost in the district court.
Well, what does the language mean to you, now do?
Judge.
No, just answer me.
Yes,
what does
yes,
it
judge.
Mean to you? Not judge. What does it mean to you?
It means the now do language in context of the letter explains the difference of the total balance of the credit card debt, and it is a credit card debt. It's being collected by...
It's now due as of this date?
The balance is the total balance, and the amount, the minimum amount of the balance is now due.
Doesn't that reflect the whole amount now due, if you're referring to the whole amount?
No, Judge, because there are two different amounts listed. There's
I
the credit card
that.
Balance, then
but
there's the now due
the
amount.
The way that you have phrased your letter.
And the way that we've phrased the letter is not only listed those two amounts, but then went on to explain the minimum portion of the balance, defined above, is the amount now due, already defined above. And then the letter went on to explain precisely what the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act requires. You have 30 days to dispute.
Isn't it true that the majority of the people that take out those loans aren't Rhodes Scholars?
I don't know, Judge. That's not the only, but I can assume that they're not Rhodes Scholars. But an unsophisticated debtor isn't a moron. An unsophisticated debtor, as Your Honors stated in the Pettit case, has to read the letters rationally. And I'll quote what the Pettit case says. An uneducated consumer possesses rudimentary knowledge about the financial world, wise enough to read collection notices with added care. They possess reasonable intelligence. They're capable of making basic logical deductions and inferences and not interpret letters in a bizarre or idiosyncratic fashion. Judge, the five cases that Mr. Phillips cited today, the Avila case, the Bartlett case, the Chauncey case, Miller, and Beach, all show the fundamental difference between the RMA letter and the letters that this court has found to be violative of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Let's take the first three, the Avila, Bartlett, and Chauncey cases. Those cases relate to the first claim, confusion claim. In those cases, well, here, unlike in those cases, RMA didn't demand immediate payment. It didn't demand payment before the 30-day validation period expired. It didn't convey a sense of extreme urgency. It didn't threaten to take some sort of action if the payment wasn't made within 30 days. It didn't use any other threats of adverse action. Didn't use bright colors or anything else. It didn't place an emphasis on one option, which is pay the debt, or the other option, dispute the debt. With respect to Miller and Beach, which Mr. Phillips relies on for the second claim, the amount of debt claim, those cases are an apposite. Both of those cases, the letters didn't even state the accurate amount of the debt being collected. They cited these unidentified principal balances and then other charges and costs. In Miller, the plaintiffs had to call a 1-800 number to figure out what the heck was being collected. In Beach, the debt collector tried to collect treble damages, attorney's fees, and costs, all of which the debt collector and the customer wasn't entitled to yet. There wasn't a lawsuit, and the consumer didn't lose the lawsuit. All five of those cases exposed the flaw. RMA's letter did exactly what the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act required, and that's what the judge, the district court, found. Now, Mr. Phillips referred to the Bartlett safe harbor, and in his brief he referred to another safe harbor, the Miller. As Your Honor has pointed out, Bartlett's safe harbor letter has been criticized, but even if it wasn't, it doesn't apply here. Because in Bartlett, the whole idea of that safe harbor language was designed for debt collectors who wanted to collect a debt and at the same time threaten litigation. RMA didn't threaten litigation, didn't threaten any adverse consequence. And the other one, in Miller, that was designed for times when you wanted to collect a constantly shifting target, is what Your Honor said in Beach. A constantly shifting target. RMA sought to collect a finite amount, the amount now due. So, if we could turn to two more cases, Johnson and Walker, and both of those were 12B6 cases, I'll note. But, in both of those cases, this court reversed the district court on the basis of the plaintiff's statement that they intended to introduce extrinsic evidence, survey or other empirical proof, to prove their confusion claim. So presumably, had they not have done that and come back to this court, appealing a summary judgment entered against them, this court would have affirmed that summary judgment because plaintiffs may not rely on the language of a letter as the sole basis for a confusion claim. Plaintiffs tried to do that. They lost. So, if I can conclude where I began, Johnson is dispositive. If all plaintiffs have to go on is the language of a letter, they must lose in the end. Plaintiffs lost in the district court. They should lose here. Your Honor should affirm the trial court. Thank you. Happy New Year.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning again. A couple of short points. First, counsel said there's no threat. And in his brief, and also in Judge Landenweber's decision, they said, you know, well, there's no threat here. And somehow that's dispositive. That's not the law. Bartlett, Avila, Chauncey, some of them there was a threat, but that wasn't the rationale for the case law. It was there was a contradiction. In fact, the Second Circuit has directly rejected that in a case called Russell versus Equifax that we cite, and that this court has cited in developing the overshadowing case law. There's no need for a threat. Russell Equifax is 74 F3rd 30, if I can read my own writing, at 35. There's no need for a threat. That may be extra, and that may help you along, but that's just not needed. Now, the issue about we needed extrinsic evidence or a survey here, and that the defendant has seized on, as defendants have done in many of my Fair Debt cases, that, oh, you got to have evidence of consumer confusion. That's not true. Okay? Walker and Marshall Mosby said you could do that if you wanted it. And those are my motions to dismiss. But in fact, in Avila, this court rejected that exact argument and said, no, you don't. You don't have to have evidence of consumer confusion. You can go on the face of the letter, especially when it's a direct contradictory time period. This court's already had that. You don't need any evidence of actual consumer confusion. And the reason that Marshall Mosby and Johnson weren't decided right on point for the consumer is it wasn't a direct conflict. There was some wiggle room there. In those cases, the collector was asking for prompt payment. Well, that's not a definitive time period. It's an undefinitive time period. Now is pretty definitive. Now is now. Today is right away, immediate. So I respectfully disagree with counsel's argument on those 3 points. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement. Court is adjourned.